Hi, who else we got?
Hi, Dennis.
Tell us who you are, where you're from, and welcome yourself to the call.
Richard from Vancouver Island. How you doing?
Richard! Hi, buddy.
Hey. Arthur?
Yeah.
Richard, who just got in on Richard Idens, is up in Vancouver, on the Vancouver Island on the coast there. And, or, let's see, you're inland, right? Where are you exactly?
I'm Campbell River, B.C.
Ah, yeah. And Richard has collected Ormus in a large vortex in the, could you describe that just a little tiny bit, Richard?
Sure.
Listen, why don't we do that in the call proper? Rather than do it
I don't want to take up Arthur's time, but I want to get Arthur and Richard acquainted with their respective techniques.
Okay, go ahead.
I collected water from a natural whirlpool, a tidal whirlpool. It's about 120 feet across when the tide's running, very dangerous one. And I collect it from the bottom end. And the water that I collect is fairly deep source. The water comes up from about 700 or 800 feet.
Mm-hmm.
And the vortex is also near a lot of magnetic ore, iron or magnetite, and it's enough to swing the compass on a boat, so there's actually a notice on some charts about it. But,
is this granular magnetite that's been laid down as placer deposit?
I would think it's probably just something like that. There's a lot of magnetite around here, but I've never been down there to see it because, of course, it's too dangerous and too deep to dive. But
right. Well, I know the Fraser River has deposited a great deal of magnetite in the lower reaches of it. Is this in the mouth of the Fraser River?
No, it's about 140-150 miles northwest of the Fraser, but it's
okay.
In a narrow channel in between Vancouver Island and the mainland. Anyhow, as I was saying, the water is deep sourced, and I believe it's accumulates some charge from the ore in the area because it's different than any water anywhere around there. It could just be that it's just very deep water as well, and it's also very lively. It has a lot of sea life in it.
Is that the area that's called Georgia Straits?
It's above Georgia Strait, and it's near near Stewart Island. It's just about a couple of miles north of Stewart Island.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a narrow channel between there and mainland and an island called Sonora Island.
You've got a number of things going on in that area that that would make it an excellent area for the sort of things that we all look for.
No kidding. I've got quite a bit of fishing experience, and I've been all over the coast, and that was the one that first attracted me, and I've sampled waters from probably 20 or 30 different areas around there since, and compared to that, it's been a waste of a lie. not really, but I mean, the yields and the and the Ormus is excellent.
Yeah. Well, you've got a lot of good things going on there. You've got good precious metal mineralization both on the mainland and on Vancouver Island. You've got deep waters coming out of the Aleutian Trench where it strikes the continental shelf.
That's the one that comes right down our channel too.
Yeah, and you've got water coming up from 6,000 feet deep there. On the whole, minerals in seawater don't vary too much from one part in the world to another, except for phosphorus. Phosphorus, as you probably know, has a tendency to precipitate out of seawater. And then where the upwelling currents against the continental shelf bring it back up off the ocean floor and into the food chain, then you get a burgeoning of phytoplankton and and everything that grazes on that, from bacteria right on up the food chain. By analyzing the phosphorus content, you know, I'm not horribly far down the coast from you, and by analyzing the phosphorus content in the water here, water, you know, down 100 feet analyzes the, as if it were 4,000 feet down, because the upwelling currents have brought from 6,000 feet the phosphorus up. So you've got that going
on. So those of you guys who have just joined the call, you're listening to Arthur Ziegler, who's our guest for today, having a little impromptu chat with Richard Idians. Right. So we're going to kick off this call with our guest this morning, Arthur Ziegler, of C-Crop fame. And Arthur is one of the senior citizens of the Ormus movement. He's been involved with the Ormus for a long time and doing an extraordinary amount of research. And, in fact, I had a fantastic conversation with Arthur last week. And it turns out that the people who are on the call for only 1 hour, you're gonna feel like you're a bit deprived when the free room has its hour up, because Arthur's got far too much information than we have got time for, even for a couple of hours. But I just want to start with welcoming you, Arthur, to the call, and we've been wanting to get you on one of these calls for a long time, and thanks for being available for us. And welcome to the call this morning. Come in, Arthur.
Thank you. I'm here.
Good. So, firstly, welcome to the call, and I appreciate you taking your time to be with us today. And before you start, I would love it if you would describe how you got into the whole Ormus thing. What was the beginning part that got you even interested in Ormus before you decided to make a business out of it?
Well, let's see. It's been, I think, about 9 years ago, 8 or 9 years ago. I was doing research with modulated gas plasmas, lasers, helium neon lasers, to see if I could do something about cancer. I'd had a good friend, one of my art dealers, that had died recently from cancer, and I was pursuing that research, and in various rabbit holes that I went down on the internet, I kept finding a reference to Ormus, and tracked that down to Barry Carter's website, which at that time was a closed website. You had to have a password to get into it. So I tracked down Barry Carter and gave him a call, and talked with him a little bit, and he let me write into the website. And I started looking at it, and I realized that some of this was exactly like work I'd been doing 25 years previous to that. For example, the wet method, what's known as the wet method in the Ormus community, I had been doing that back in the late 70s and early 80s. In fact, I thought I had invented it myself. I developed it by myself, but then found out that there were a lot of other researchers and metallurgists that used it to extract precious metal values from leach solutions. People didn't like to do it because there you have a lot of iron hydroxides that are made, and these are big, fluffy, gelatinous precipitates that are just monsters to try to do anything with. Not nearly as nice to work with as the hydroxide precipitates from magnesium and calcium. But I looked at this and said, you know, this is what I was doing. And at that time, I had been chasing elusive precious metal values, in the state of Nevada, what Hudson was referring to as ghost gold in Arizona. I was the mining community in Nevada referred to as phantom gold. So I had abandoned that research for quite a few years, but finding the information on Barry's site renewed my interest, and with a different aim. Rather than looking at it from the standpoint of trying to recover precious metal values, why I was more interested in health and in the possibility of spiritual applications. So I got back involved in it. So there you are, Dennis.
Well, thank you. Now, let me just say for the guys who have just joined the call, you're listening to Arthur Ziegler of C-Crop fame, and he's giving a bit of history about how he got involved in the whole Ormus thing. So, Arthur, and thanks for being with us again. So when you got hold of Barry, what happened?
Well, you know, I went through the information on his website and started doing some experimenting. At that time, I had a, you know, I live right on the sea, on a bay that empties into the sea. And at that time, I had a boat that was large enough and seaworthy enough to go well offshore. And I started going offshore about 35 miles and collecting seawater from various depths. And the first precipitates that I made, I made some precipitates and took a tablespoonful of it and walked out into my garden and had an ecstatic experience.
Wow.
So at that point, I knew that I was dealing with something that I needed to continue working with.
Uh-huh.
And I've you know, pretty much dedicated my time to that ever since.
Was that before or after we went up and met the Essene?
Oh, well before.
Oh, uh-huh.
Well before.
And then I think it was 99 or 98, we went up and met, Arthur and I went up and met the Essene.
We met,
was after that?
A little town that is close to where his mine and mill site are located. We had not met in person. We'd, you know, spoken on the phone a number of times. We had not met in person until we both arrived on that site in separate vehicles. And then the next day, you and me and my wife went out to sit down and visit with him and go through his mill and laboratory and his research facilities.
And maybe most significant, he showed us his giant nuts.
He did show us his giant nuts, and you got a famous picture of my back.
Oh, yeah. That picture of Arthur, of the walnut trees. There's two trees, one that didn't get the ormus, and then another one that did. And Arthur's back is turned to the camera in both those pictures. He wasn't sure whether he wanted to go public with this yet.
So those trees were at the Essene's place, not at Arthur's place.
That's right.
No, those are at his place. And he had a number of trees there, same variety. They'd all been planted at the same time. Part of them had received no treatment, and part of them had received treatments periodically from the time they were transplanted in. And they were much larger. The leaves were much larger than on the untreated trees, and the nuts were much larger. Well, I'm sure all of you have seen pictures of Barry's nuts.
Yeah, keep talking about them.
And then later on, I made a separate trip back with my wife because the Essene had wanted some C11 precipitates, And I took him a bucket of concentrated C11 for his own personal uses. And he served me some of his honey wine made with ormus. Very good stuff. I had the recipe kicking around here for a couple of years, but I've been unable to find it recently.
Now, did you notice a higher alcohol content in that wine?
I noticed that it was very good wine.
Uh-huh.
I can't say whether it had a higher alcohol content or not. It was effective.
There's one thing that he told us that we haven't been able to really confirm is that you can double the alcohol content that you get before the yeast is killed by the alcohol.
That's something I probably ought to check out because I used to make a lot of wine. I used to make Cabernet Sauvignon a barrel at a time,
mm-hmm.
and haven't for a number of years, but I still have all of the winemaking equipment and test equipment. So I could do that. I could verify. And it certainly wouldn't surprise me
mm-hmm.
that the yeast would be more viable and able to continue working. The thing with yeast is, as the alcohol content goes up, they become less viable. They can only tolerate a certain amount of alcohol.
Uh-huh.
And it wouldn't surprise me at all that they would be more viable longer at a higher concentration of alcohol.
Yeah, that would be a great experiment to try. And
if you're going to do that experiment, Arthur, let me just volunteer as one of the participants in the experiment.
Well, you know, honey is notorious for being difficult to ferment, and he had made this wine with honey. I think he did, as I recall, it was honey and sugar. I don't think
wow.
it was honey only.
Wow. So one of the things
you made reference to, Arthur, was C11. Now, most people wouldn't know that, and I think I'm right, and that C11 was the name that you gave to your precipitate for marketing purposes originally. Is that correct?
Well, no. That's the Essenes term. Supposedly 11 M-state minerals in precipitates.
There's probably a lot more, but 11 that he measured.
Yeah, that was his terminology, and whether or not there's any validity to that or not, it would be hard for me to judge.
Okay, that's how the term came about. Thank you. What was the original name that you called your commercial product?
I just called it doing the hydroxide drop.
Ah, doing the hydroxide drop trademark.
but wet method sounds a lot nicer, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Friendlier.
Please don't mute me.
Mute them, Barry.
Okay. So, Arthur?
Yes.
When did you first start trying this with plants?
Well, quite a bit further on. Quite a bit further on. As you know, I did a lot of research work with the Ormus materials, trying to develop an assay method, trying to simply verify what a lot of other people had claimed.
Mm-hmm.
trying to do reduction to verify, in fact, that there were precious metals involved. And my attention was on those things, also on effects on animals, effects on people, spiritual effects. And it was quite a bit later on. My youngest son, was raising orchids as a hobby. And I gave him a bottle of precipitates for his own personal use. He gave me a call and said, Dad, you need to look at this. I said, what? He says, well, these orchids have more blooms. The blooms stay on much longer. there's been a tremendous change in these plants that I've put these precipitates on.
Wow.
So at that point, I started, and I should say that I am an organic gardener. I have a large garden. At that point, I started using it in the garden, experimenting with it. I had already done animal experimentation with tremendous results.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, I was very concerned about finding a test to determine bioactivity. And that was when you contacted Phil Callahan, Dr. Callahan, that many of the people on the call may know of. He was an entomologist that worked his whole career as a government scientist for the USDA, research scientist. You contacted Phil Callahan, and he recommended a test to you for my use involving germination of, well, he recommended rye, I use wheat, germinating the seeds and letting them go for a couple of weeks, and then washing off the roots, washing the soil off the roots, and weighing the entire plant, both top and root mass, which I started doing then and do constantly, continually since that time. I have these tests going. I desiccate the plant before weighing, and I don't separate out the tops from the bottom. Some researchers do.
Uh-huh.
I don't.
So you dry them out, and now you'd get better results if you didn't dry them out, wouldn't you?
Well, yes, but would it mean anything? When you compare dry weight to dry weight, you've got something that's not going to vary by moisture content. That's the reason for desiccating both the treated plant and the control.
Mm-hmm.
That way that you're not going to have extra water in say the treated, giving a greater result. When you dry the plant, you're looking at the proteins, the sugars, the hormones, vitamins, etc.
What kind of results were you seeing?
Well, one thing that we noticed immediately was that the root mass is almost always greater, generally in the vicinity of 30-35% greater. In addition to that, well, dry weights fall into that range too, anywhere from 15-100% greater, generally in the vicinity of 35%.
You know, Arthur, one of the things that we managed to slide by was how you even got interested in applying your ocean precipitate agriculturally. I mean, what brought you to that? The question was, what precipitated you even applying your precipitate agriculturally?
Well, the fact that it had a noticeable effect. It,
yeah, but why did you even go down that track?
Well, from the results that my son had on his orchids.
So that was the beginning part? That's what sparked your attention about the agricultural applications?
Well, it was a confirmation of what I'd seen at the Essenes. And I've got to say that it took confirmation. I know that many people are almost worshipful about the Essene. I'm not. He gave me half a dozen processes that none of which worked. And I was very skeptical about the man and the things he claimed, so I never put too much credence in the walnuts, but when my own son had extraordinary results, then I started looking at it and experimenting with it.
Now, you've also, you said
at one point that you've measured some nutritional improvements.
I have not done that work personally. It's all been third party.
Uh-huh.
My distributor in the Netherlands did work with antioxidant content in hydroponically raised cucumbers. Now, I've got to say that soilless hydroponics is not the best application for sea crop because you don't have the possibility of microflora symbiosis in the rhizosphere of the plant.
Mm-hmm.
So we just don't see the kind of results in hydroponics that we see when the plants are in soil. Nonetheless, he had between 8 to 14% increases in antioxidant content in the cucumbers when he added sea crop to the hydroponic fluid. Alfalfa has been checked out a couple of, by several different parties.
Mm-hmm.
And treated alfalfa has greater nutritive value all the way around. More protein, more soluble protein, higher vitamin content, and then the physical characteristics vary quite a bit as well. The plants are more supple. The stems are more supple to where, you know, cattle feeding on alfalfa hay generally will eat just the leaves and push the stems aside. But when the alfalfa has been treated with sea crop, they will eat more of the stems. Because of the fact that it's not as stiff, it's more supple.
And do you think that it's changed the sugar content in the stems?
Oh, definitely, absolutely.
So maybe that's why they're attracted to the stems as well. Is it?
That could certainly enter into it.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, Brix refractometer testing on all the plants that it's been applied to has shown an increase in sugar content. Well, Brix refractometer testing shows sugar, vitamins, hormones, everything that's in solution in the sap. So I can't say that it's just sugar, but it's predominantly sugar.
Mm-hmm.
And that shows increases all the way around.
Now, the most frequent question that I get when I do my lectures is, how does it taste? Do you have any comments? You've got pictures on your website of raspberries that were treated with sea crop, and your neighbors didn't have any sea crop. And, of course, yours are much bigger and look better, but did you taste it, the neighbors?
I should mention that I got my raspberry plants from the neighbor at the same time that they put those plants in. They gave me some, and I put my plants in. They were the same variety and planted in at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Tremendous difference. Tremendous difference in taste. No comparison.
Was it better?
Oh, of course.
What was better about the taste?
Certainly they were sweeter because of the higher sugar content, but then I would assume that there's more esters as well and more of the volatile compounds that give something taste.
Uh-huh.
And in fact, raspberries are known to be one of the great antioxidant cancer-fighting foods. And so I imagine there's all those bioflavonoids and all the other biochemical compounds that would also be enriched in there too.
I would assume so. The testing has not yet taken place to the degree that I would certainly like to see. My hope is that we will do more nutrition testing this year.
Oh, great. Now, you had some apples that were tested. I believe you have pictures on your website. I'm pretty sure I have them on mine as well. And
some of which
they were apples?
Oh, yes.
Were they conventionally raised apples?
They were conventionally raised. Yes, they
okay,
were.
Okay, not organic.
Not
organic. And you described the one of the apples was from a tree that was nearby the other apple tree, and one didn't get sea crop and the other did. What was the difference between the taste of those apples?
Well, those were delicious apples, and
delicious.
I will not normally eat a red delicious apple.
Why not?
Because they probably because of the fact that they're picked young and don't mature, but and then they're stored for whatever reason. They're nasty. They're mealy. They don't have a good flavor. The acids aren't well developed. Often the sugar isn't well developed.
Mm-hmm.
I did taste both of the apples that you mentioned, the ones in the picture that are the treated and the untreated.
Mm-hmm.
And the untreated tasted like cardboard, just like I would expect a red delicious apple to taste. The treated was, in fact, delicious. It was great. It tasted
mm-hmm.
very good.
Like you'd hope something like that would taste. Yeah.
It was crisp. It was tart. It was sweet.
A few years back, I'm not sure I was using sea crop. I was using seawater precipitate for sure. And I did it on my carrots. Now, anymore, when I go to the local food co-op and get organic carrots, they taste like cardboard. I mean, they taste awful just eating the carrot. And so they've started selling just these little baby carrots now, because they taste pretty good. But the full-grown carrots don't taste good at all. And a friend of mine came over, and he's been organically gardening for a long time, and he tasted one of my carrots that I grew out in my garden, and he said it was the best carrot he'd ever eaten. He said it's sweet. It tastes like carrot juice. And I realized that, yeah, it does. It's something that I'm used to. It tastes so much better than the carrots that are, you know, grown conventionally, even the organic.
Well,
and then
the thing is, you can grow organic food, but if the soil is worn out, it's not going to be the same as growing something in virgin soil or something that's been treated with sea crop. In order for a plant to have a fully functional biology, at least according to some researchers, Dr. Bruce Tineo, for one, he says that you have to have 59 minerals for a plant to have a fully functional biosystem.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, with conventional agriculture, it's all NPK, NPK, your nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium. That used to be all it was. Now they finally admitted up to a dozen minerals that in trace amounts may be necessary for agriculture. They're slowly coming on board, slowly realizing that it takes more than that. You know, plants are very smart, and they're able to substitute one mineral for another. Well, first of all, let's talk about enzymes.
Mm-hmm.
Enzymes are proteins, most of which involve a mineral cofactor. Mineral cofactors are minerals that have to be part of a protein in order for that protein to have a certain function. For example, vitamin B12.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't have that single cobalt atom in the center of that molecule, you don't have vitamin B12. So if cobalt is unavailable, vitamin B12 cannot be made in the body. Now, in plants, all the biological operations that they perform in order to be a plant are dependent on catalysts, enzyme catalysts. And these catalysts cannot be made by the plant, this protein cannot be made, unless the necessary mineral cofactors are present.
Oh.
Now, plants are very smart. They can substitute one mineral for another, but at a cost. Efficiency is lost. And when this... And this is not always true. They can't always substitute, but in many cases they can. In some cases, if the mineral isn't present they need, they simply can't make the necessary enzymes. In many cases they can, but at a cost. For example, as a byproduct of their biological operation that is catalyzed by the enzyme, if the enzyme is made with a different mineral, they might be producing a toxin as a byproduct rather than what the normal byproduct would be.
Right.
So when you add this up, if there is enough inefficiency, pretty soon you have scrawny plants that simply don't develop well. They're diseased. They're ill. I'm gonna read something here. This is from a seminar I spoke at a couple of months ago. Let's see, some USDA figures. For example, according to USDA compiled statistics from 1914 to 1992, a period of 80 years, the mineral content of the average apple has declined as follows. Calcium content has declined by 48%, phosphorus by 85%, iron by 96%, potassium by 2%, magnesium by 83%. To put it another way, the average American apple in 1992 compared to the average apple in 1914 had 52% of the calcium content, 15% of the phosphorus, only 4% of the iron content, 99% of the potassium, and only 17% of the magnesium.
Now, this doesn't even include the Ormus minerals, which are never measured and probably are depleted at a greater rate than the others, which are... known to be required according to conventional agriculture, right?
And we are supplying, well, a mineral, okay, we're supplying over 80 elements. There are 84 elements in seawater in detectable quantities by today's methods of detection. So we have 84 elements. Now, any chemical element or combination that has a crystalline form when it's dried is considered to be a mineral.
Mm-hmm.
So in minerals, there's over 100 minerals in seawater. And when we supply sea crop to the garden or, you know, whatever other agricultural usage, we're supplying in excess of the 59 minerals that are needed for a fully functional biosystem. I hesitated at 59 because other researchers say that it takes 64 minerals to have healthy human DNA.
So what makes you think that there's Ormus in the seawater?
Well, number one, of course, that depends on how you define Ormus.
Mm-hmm.
the precious metal elements in a non-metal form.
All right. I can't swear to the platinum. I have not been successful in reducing significant amounts of metallic platinum out of seawater.
Mm-hmm.
Gold, I have been able to remove from seawater as gold, put it in the scale and weigh it. Repeatedly I've done this, 500 times the amount of gold that's supposed to be there. There's no question in my mind, I've satisfied myself at least, that the phenomena we're seeing are at least in part based on conventionally non-assayable precious metal.
Haven't you figured out, David Hudson said that a certain portion of it will not assay.
Well, there are procedures that can be run. Okay, when you do an assay for precious metals by chemical methods, you're looking at fractional precipitation,
mm-hmm.
fractional solubilization. You're selectively solubilizing a certain portion of what you're analyzing, or selectively precipitating out a certain portion.
Mm-hmm.
It is possible to treat what you're investigating in certain ways that will make it, by conventional parting methods, make it respond to where you're getting large volumes of material dropping out, for example, as platinum or palladium or gold. Now, these are not assayable as the metals, but yet they are coming out in the position that the metal would come out if it were metal. Don Duke and David Hudson had a method of putting materials in these positions where they would part out as the metals, in the positions where the metals would be found.
Mm-hmm.
There you have this black material. This is what, from what I understand from Hudson's statements, that this was what he was calling rhodium oxide that he was trying to sell for purposes of batteries. I've produced that by a different method, and it's not too difficult to produce these methods, produce these materials that Hudson was producing in a non-metallic state, the separations of these, whatever they are,
uh-huh.
substances. In fact, I can give a general outline on how to do that if anyone's interested.
Maybe a little bit later in the call.
Yeah.
So you've actually done lots of assays on your product.
I spent years, mm-hmm. years in the laboratory trying to take these things apart and make sense out of them,
uh-huh.
and do it in a consistent manner. Hell, Barry, I spent 10 years doing it. 30 years ago.
Right, right.
And at that time, of course, I was chasing the metals. I would
uh-huh.
get these anomalous assays that were just astronomical out of a material
uh-huh.
that wouldn't normally assay, and then turn around and not be able to do it again. I should probably tell you a story about that point in time.
Yeah.
I was raising metal-eating bacteria, Thiobacillus ferrooxidans. These bacteria live around metal ores, metallic deposits. They're just there. Base metal deposits generally contain a fairly large amounts of metals as sulfides. Iron sulfide, for example, the infamous fool's gold.
Mm-hmm.
copper sulfides, silver sulfides, gold sulfide. And these bacteria eat these sulfides. It's what they do for a living. And they will frequently redeposit the other metals, both the base metal and precious metals, as in more concentrated form, making an economic mineral deposit. So I was raising these bacteria, and one of the byproducts of their life cycle, by the way, is thiourea, which I worked with for a number of years. I had a document come into my hands that was in Russian, and I got it translated by a man who had a master's in Slavic languages and another one in chemistry. And it was all about how to work with thiourea in an acidic solution with an oxidizer. It will put all of the precious metals into solution. And I worked with that and worked with the thiobacillus for 10 years. At that time, I noticed that, this comes back to the mineral cofactors. I noticed that I couldn't keep these bacteria healthy unless I added very small amounts of trace elements. Even though I was raising them in soil, I couldn't keep them healthy unless I added other soil. Mount Morillonite clay was one that I used frequently the broad spectrum of minerals that it contains. In fact, I had one ore out of the Trinity Alps in California. It was running 80 ounces of silver and 5.5 ounces of gold to the ton. And I could not get thiourea to put the values into solution. But when I added a small amount of Mount Morillonite to the solution, instantly it dissolved and went into solution. To show the importance of mineral cofactors in with
in chemical processes.
An organic chemical process with something that isn't even alive, but is an organic byproduct of the life cycle of the thiobacillus.
Wow. So you've had a great deal of experience working with these same elements, and you suspect strongly that they're at what level do you think that they're in the sea crop product?
Well, if you go by David Hudson's estimates, if you go by the Essene's estimates, if you go by the partings that I have been able to produce, not in metallic form, but in this black gunk that separates out into different positions when you do a traditional precious metal parting. All I can say is it's a huge amount. A huge amount of the the mineral content of sea crop. Is about 12.5% solids. If you evaporate it down to dryness and weight it, mineral content's about 12.5%. As opposed to, for example, C11 wet method precipitates, evaporated to dryness would be about 8 grams in a, from a liter of precipitates.
What percent?
0.8.
Oh, okay. So it's a much higher mineral content than wet method precipitate. Okay.
Much higher. Yeah. The densest wet method precipitates I was ever able to achieve by decantation was about 18 grams to the liter.
Wow.
And that was through, a method, not by your traditional wet method That was by another method that I developed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Wow.
And so that's 18 grams per liter. Now, we're talking a whole heck of a lot more than that in sea crop.
Oh, yeah. So now you've been getting some results from the Midwest. There's some gentleman out there that is selling it to Amish. Is that right?
He is Amish, and he is an agronomist that consults and distributes agricultural products to the Amish community in Ohio, Indiana, and Pennsylvania, primarily.
Mm-hmm.
He serves other areas as well. And, yeah, he had used other sea mineral preparations previously, and he is extremely happy to be using sea crop now instead.
Is there a difference in application rate?
Well, there is. The one company that has most of the market and is the best known spends a lot of money on advertising. They claim that their product is effective at a tenth of a gallon per acre. But I've personally tested it against sea crop, using both in the range of 3 gallons per acre.
Mm-hmm.
And sea crop was much more effective, and they charge five times as much for their product.
Uh huh. Wow.
Yeah. So we're able to get the product out to the farmer, going through a distributor, transporting it across the continent, getting it out to the farmer in the field. We're getting it out for about $15 a gallon.
And that would be $15 per gallon.
Yeah.
What does it do for the crop? I mean, why would somebody spend that much money on a third of an acre or a fifth of an acre?
Well, you've got to realize these guys are spending large monies on their agricultural inputs. It's not unusual for a farmer to spend $1,000 an acre for anhydrous ammonia.
Oh, really?
Which is horrible stuff. I mean, it kills everything. It is just sure death for the soil microflora.
Mm-hmm.
Kills all the worms, kills much of the bacteria.
Mm-hmm.
Bad stuff. Huge amounts of money. We had one farmer, popcorn farmer in Indiana, was able to cut his nitrogen use back by 80% by applying 2 gallons per acre of sea crop. Yeah.
So in other words, half of that $1,000 an acre.
Yeah. More than half. He was.
Yeah. Wow. So,
well, I don't know what this man's nitrogen cost was. I know he was using 200 pounds per acre previously and is now using 40.
Wow.
And got a 40-some percent increase in his crop.
So in other words, what do people typically report that they use less fertilizer?
Well, there has
half,
been there's,
50% less, 80% less.
I don't have a lot of reports back on that yet. You've got to realize that farmers are and need to be very conservative. You know, their livelihood depends on that crop. They get one chance per year,
right?
And they are not about to trifle with that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going slowly as far as people making changes.
Mm-hmm.
And our information, as it comes in from one crop cycle from 1 year, why then we have recommendations we can make to people for the following crop cycle. It goes slowly.
Uh-huh.
But we are getting, you know, at this point, we've got thousands of acres per year being treated with C-crop. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah, changes are happening. And we are developing more information as far as how best to use it, how best to piggyback it onto conventional farming methods, where the farmers are going to be more likely to utilize it.
Could you discuss some of those methods?
Well, right now, there are various ways of applying fertilizer. It's recently been discovered in conventional farming that using what they call a starter fertilizer, or putting a certain amount of fertilizer right in the furrow with the seed or near the seed so that it doesn't burn when the seed germinates, actually is much more beneficial than applying large amounts of fertilizer after emergence. And I've been working with farmers on how best to utilize their planting equipment to be able to do that with C-crop at the same time that they apply their conventional NPK fertilizer.
Uh-huh.
C-crop will form a potassium orthophosphate if it's mixed with conventional liquid NPK fertilizers.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't know whether this is a problem yet or not. We've had good results even when that's happened, so it may not be a problem. But it does, for a while at least, sequester at least some of the phosphorus into a non-soluble form.
Right.
And I, of course, have a concern that it may do the same thing with the sea crop, but it appears not to. We're not sure yet.
What about root dips?
Well, now root dips are they're great. Dr. Ed McGauley at the University of Louisiana at Baton Rouge did work with using sea crop as a root dip for eggplant, peppers, tomatoes, and strawberries, and he did that with no other additional treatment, just root dip only at the time of transplant for those species, and saw from 25 to 76% increase in yield.
Wow.
Yeah.
Did he happen to mention how it tasted?
No. I don't have that information. I wish I did. But I wasn't involved in the testing. This was a third-party test done by an agricultural chemical company that was paying for the test. I had no involvement in that at all.
Wow.
Even though you are very familiar with the effects of wormers on agriculture, do you have your own garden, Arthur?
Yes, I do. I try to eat something out of it every day.
How does it hold up over the winter?
Well, very well. I had giant red mustard that I've been able to eat off of through the fall into early winter, and it's in beautiful condition right now. There was a period for a couple of months when I wasn't able to harvest off of it. It's held up very well through the winter.
Oh, great. Do you have any kale? My kale, I've been eating it all winter.
Yeah, my kale held up very well through the winter. I'm getting the florets off of it now. It's trying to bolt.
Dennis, we should have some questions now from the free room.
Yeah, let's have it. So anyone in the free room wants to ask any questions of Arthur before you guys are summarily cut off?
Go ahead.
Hi, Arthur, I have a question. Have you ever experimented using probiotics to digest the sea crop or adding the probiotics to the soil with the sea crop?
Yes. I did some work, it's been half a dozen years ago, with EM, which you may be familiar with. And at that time, I didn't notice a lot of difference, and I decided that the climate that we have here is it's fairly cold. We have the same summer heat characteristics as northern coastal Maine. We have like 3 days a year that are in the 80s. The rest of the time is considerably cooler. And I decided that the Okinawan bacteria maybe just were much more used to a semi-tropical climate. Now, I am currently experimenting with some bacteria from Tineo Laboratories. Can't say what the results are yet. What I can tell you is I've done soil testing after sea crop treatment, and in just 2 weeks' time, we get a tremendous increase in the indigenous microflora in the soil, both bacteria and the fungi. We get a very substantial increase. So my approach is to encourage the indigenous probiotic, the indigenous soil microflora. Because, hey, they're used to the conditions there. They've been surviving in spite of everything. And if we can give them some help and help them to thrive, why, I think that makes a big difference. It certainly improved my soil here, I can tell you that.
What have you noticed different about your soil?
Oh, the tilt is considerably better. We have... I live on top of basalt here, and our soils are you know, basically a clay breakdown from basalt plagonite, and it has helped my clay soil in my garden become much more aerated.
I see. Yeah.
Much less sticky.
Yeah, I had a problem with that. I had last summer I had one of my sunflowers fell over after I watered because the soil was just so aerated that the root wad wasn't big enough, I guess, to hold it upright. And when it fell over, there were all these white fibers around the root wad. And those would be mycorrhizal fungi. So it became so aerated that the sunflower, so I went and propped up some of my other sunflowers that were leaning a little bit. And, you know, my soil, when I walk through it, it's soft. It's not hard like it used to be. Have you noticed that?
Oh, yeah. The tilt of the soil has just increased tremendously since I've been treating the sea crop.
Wow.
And my distributor in the Midwest who is treating thousands of acres says that it's invariable. He notices it everywhere.
Every single time?
Yeah.
Wow. Now, one person in Australia noticed that they're going through a drought, and he commented that his product, he's got an EM mixed with seawater precipitate product. And he noticed that some farmers were coming to him afterwards, after they'd applied it, and after they'd had some results, and asking, where is all the water coming from? Because they were in the midst of drought, and their plants, their soil was all wet, and the neighbors wasn't, and nobody could figure out why. Have you had any drought experience with this stuff?
Well, Barry, where I live, we get 85 to 120 inches of rain a year.
Well, I know, but
so, I don't personally have a lot of drought experience. No,
right.
But I have had many people tell me that plants treated with C crop are much more stress tolerant, all kinds of stress, heat, cold, drought, all the way around.
Any other questions from the free room?
Yeah, I'd like to ask a question. I'm here in Panama, and we have heavy rains all the time as well here. But I'd like to know, when you say 3 gallons to the acre, how do you administer that? And is it during time periods you administer a part of it and then a couple of weeks later the rest, or how?
Well, a split application is certainly the safest, especially if you live in an area of heavy rainfall where your first application might get, washed down and become
yeah.
unavailable to the plant. Split application is very safe. I like to see the treatment as early as possible in the life cycle of the plant, either at time of transplant or in the furrow or right after emergence when the plant is in the two leaf stage, true leaves. To drench the soil with a 1% or a 2% solution is excellent. And then to come back 2 or 3 weeks later with a second treatment. And really, that's quite enough at that point. In the fall, when weather cools off, if you start having a mildew problem with, any of the member of the cucumber family, your melons or squash cucumbers that are prone to mildew infestation, you can use C-Crop at a 1 or 1.5% foliar spray, and it'll knock the mildew right back. Not only will it knock the mildew back, it also has the added benefit of increasing the sugar content of your crop at the same time.
Okay. All right. Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Any one last question from the free room?
Could I ask one more question, please?
Go ahead.
I was wondering if you have a very high clay content in the soil, and even if you've amended the soil, if you add the seed crop, would that make the drainage much better in the soil?
That's what I have observed, and numerous other people as well.
Uh-huh. Spray it on the actual foliage. Or is that just applicable to the soil?
No, you can spray it on the foliage, but you're going to get a greater effect if you use a soil drench, if you dilute it and apply it to the soil. Because what we're looking at doing is increasing symbiosis in the rhizosphere of the plant, the root ball of the plant. We're looking at increasing symbiosis there with the bacteria and the fungi in the soil. The plant will exude a polysaccharides on the roots and rootlets, which feed the soil microflora, and they in turn will solubilize minerals in the soil and feed it to the plant. And that's what we're doing with the seed crop, is stimulating that activity. And that in turn will increase the tilth of your soil. The seed crop itself doesn't increase the tilt of your soil. It's the soil microflora that do that.
And they also store water. So the water isn't going right down through the soil. Yes, you have better drainage, but you don't have necessarily greater loss.
No, you have better retention,
better retention.
Of moisture in the soil. Yeah.
Thank you.
Not only that, but by loosening clay particles, you develop a better cation exchange capacity in the soil.
And what does that do?
That, the plants like that, the soil microflora like that, soluble minerals that might normally get washed out of the soil are retained in the soil, and temporarily sequestered so that they are released over a period of time as needed by the plant.
Mm-hmm. Recently, somebody asked me, is it a good idea to add rock dust, like magnetite rock dust or volcanic rock dust or whatever, in addition to the sea crop or the seawater precipitate?
It certainly won't hurt a thing.
What would be the advantage to it?
Well, it might in fact be an improvement. I don't know. Haven't done it. Couldn't say.
Well, I would guess that the microflora are basically getting more sources of those mineral nutrients if you've added them back into the soil, or at least into the top of the soil. They'd probably be deeper in the soil if the soil has been leached from conventional agriculture.
It would stand to reason that that would be the case.
Yeah.
A big problem in soils is not so much a lack of minerals as lack of available minerals.
Ah.
Phosphorus, for example, is a big one. Mm. You know, phosphorus is ubiquitous. It's everywhere. Is it available? Is it in a soluble form? No. It's
right.
Locked up. And the bacteria and fungi, there are fungi that make phosphoric acid out of phosphorus in the rocks that's normally locked up. The soil microflora puts these minerals into a form that is soluble and usable by the plant. So, is the soil truly deficient in minerals? In other words, not present at all, or are the minerals there in a form that is inaccessible, unavailable to the plant? That's the question. And if they're not present at all, why then adding the rock dust would certainly enhance things, sure.
But in most cases, you suspect that they're probably there, they're just not soluble. And adding the sea crop helps the plants and the microflora in the soils to solubilize them and make them more available to the plants. And that's why, if you're talking about adding fertilizer, you're talking about or any minerals, you're talking about hundreds of gallons per acre rather than 3 gallons per acre, right?
Yeah. We're recommending to farmers, depending on the crop, depending on the usage, 2 to 4 gallons per acre.
Uh-huh.
So yeah, we're coming in with their sea crop bill in anywhere from $30 to $60 per acre.
Uh-huh. And this diminishes their fertilizer bill, which may be up to $1,000 per acre.
Yeah, we don't know. You know, we have not done the study yet to know how much they can cut their nitrogen back.
Mm-hmm.
But what work has been done has shown that nitrogen can be cut back. We just don't know how much, but it's certainly enough to pay for their sea crop.
Oh, wow. Very good.
And they're not out there killing the fish worms and the bacteria with anhydrous liquid ammonia.
Exactly. Yeah.
They're improving the soil. I have one distributor in Vermont. He's a dairy farmer,
mm-hmm.
and he's been doing work pulling a subsoil plow. This plow goes down a couple of feet and stirs everything up, loosens the soil. When you have cattle out in fields concentrating all that weight on their little hooves for as many years as has occurred in that area, why they really compact the soil.
Mm-hmm.
Pulling this subsoil plow and then applying 2 gallons of sea crop per acre together with 6 gallons of skimmed milk, unpasteurized skimmed milk. He claims to be developing 8 inches of new topsoil in 1 year.
Oh, wow.
Doubled the thickness of his topsoil. Normally it takes 30 years to make an inch of topsoil.
That is incredible.
Yeah, he sent me some pictures of the holes that he dug, and and sure enough, you could see a big change. You know, whether he's actually created that much new humus by sequestering CO2 out of the atmosphere, I don't know, but it sure was dramatic in the photos.
Boy, I'd sure like to see a copy of those photos.
I might be able to come up with that.
That'd be great.
I'd have to ask his permission. He's trying he's trying to get put together a company for selling credits for taking CO2 out of the atmosphere.
Oh, that'd be excellent, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
I think that's one of the great potentials for seawater precipitate is that it's gonna sequester carbon.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, you're not just getting bigger plants on top of the ground. You're getting greater growth in the microflora under the surface.
And banking carbon.
Exactly. You're carbonizing your soil, literally.
Yeah.
Do you have some any results with animals that have been given us? I know that the sea crop product is, as far as I know, the only product that is certified organic and for animal consumption.
Yeah, I can give you the results that my distributor in the Netherlands did. This was in 2006. The testing involved 250,000 individuals, boiler chicks.
Mm-hmm.
These are normally raised to 6 weeks of age and then butchered at that point. The results were, let's see here. He gave, this was just an absurdly small amount of dosage. He was giving 0.02 milliliters of sea crop per kilogram of body weight per day.
Oh, uh-huh.
0.02, 0.02 of 1 milliliter.
Wow.
Per kilogram of body weight per day per individual. Let's see, mortality reduction. In all cases, there's been a reduction in mortality in the treated populations as compared to the control groups. Mortality during the vulnerable first 2 weeks of life has been reduced by as much as 90%. Overall average improvement of mortality figures for the entire 6 week growing cycle has been between 5 to 15%. Foot infections. The reduction in feet infection as compared with control groups has been as great as 85%. Skin abnormalities. The reduction in skin abnormalities has been as great as 66%. Weight gain. In most tests, there's been an increased weight gain in the treated animals, averaging 3 to 10%. Breast meat, the ratio of valuable breast meat content has been increased by 10%. Feed conversion efficiency, and this is a big one. In all cases, there's been an improvement in feed to meat conversion efficiency as compared to the controls. The range of improvement's been between 3 to 13%.
Wow, that means less food, that they eat less food and they gain more weight.
Not only that, they achieve the desired weight about 5 days to a week earlier.
Oh, wow.
than the control. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
I have right now a PhD in Davis, California, who is trying to set up a similar test in the United States right now with one of the larger chicken producers. Hopefully we can get that to occur sometime this year. And hopefully the results will be comparable to what was done in the Netherlands.
Didn't you recently get some new results with cattle that aren't quite really totally nailed down yet?
Well, yeah, I've got results on cattle, but, you know, this would have to come under hearsay, really. I mean, it's...
Hearsay is about all we're getting from just about everybody else in the Ormus community, so let's go for it.
Okay, well, there's no controls run. It's just anecdotal. Go to my website and bring up this one page here.
Oh, you've already you've put some information on your website on it.
I did.
What is your website?
That is ccrop.com with a hyphen, SEA-CROP.com. Let's see. In 2007, a dairy farmer in Vermont, now this is a guy that did the subsoil plow, treated part of his fields with C-crop. He said that whenever the cows were turned into the C-crop treated field to graze, the butterfat content of their milk would increase noticeably.
Wow.
Let's see. In 2008, a farmer in the Midwest did a test with a 4-acre hay field. C-crop was used on one half of the field, and the other half received only normal fertilization. Later in the season, cattle were turned loose into the field. The cows ate the forage in the C-crop-treated portion of the field down to the ground before they moved over to graze on the conventionally treated half of the field.
Well, we're not dumb.
No. Cows aren't nearly as dumb as a lot of people would think.
A lot of people, maybe. Yeah.
And let's see. In 2008, a certified organic dairy farm in the Midwest treated their hay fields. I believe this was Wisconsin, by the way. Mm-hmm. Treated their hay fields with C-crop. During the winter, when the dairy cows were fed on the dried hay from those fields, they ate from 25 to 30% less hay than normal because their hunger was more readily satisfied with the nutrient-dense fodder. The farmer stated that he had a lot of hay left in the barn than more than normal for this late in the winter.
Wow.
It's all anecdotal, but...
Did they gain as much weight?
Well, these are dairy cattle. They're not...
Oh, I see. Okay.
Weight gain.
Uh-huh.
Have you experimented with domestic animals to see if a minute amount could benefit, like a dog or a cat?
I have a number of customers who are giving it to animals and say that the animals do well with it.
What does well mean? Does that mean health-wise they're healthier or they're more robust or they're...
Both.
What's that? Both, uh-huh. And just, for instance, do they put, you know, what percent... Would you take the weight, for instance, of a dog or a cat and do what percent of like, am I in their water, or how do they add that?
In their water, and that should be changed every day if you're going to do this. I recommend one of two ways. You can either go by body weight, and that would be 0.04 or 0.05 milliliters per kilogram of body weight per day. That's also, a decent amount for primates. The other way would be to add a teaspoon to a tablespoon of C-crop to a gallon of water, and then just use that for the drinking water.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Now, I've got...
Hello?
Hello.
Hi. I was wondering about if the animals can take that C-crop, how about humans? How would that be?
It's not legal for humans to take C-crop.
Oh,
C-crop.
That's just like goat's milk.
Arthur can't recommend that people consume it in their water. Nevertheless, we keep hearing reports
that people are using it in their water. They say that they take a teaspoon to a tablespoon and put it in their drinking water, and I drink it. I mean, they say they drink it at about the rate of half a gallon a day with that sea crop in there. And go ahead.
Did you say a teaspoon or a tablespoon?
Between a teaspoon and a tablespoon in 4 liters of water, a gallon of water approximately.
Good. Okay. I'll check it out. I mean, I'm going to do it.
Well, we don't recommend
Thanks.
That you do it.
I know.
I do it, but I can't recommend that you do.
Exactly.
Right. It's because legally you can't, correct?
Right.
Exactly.
We put
right
Thank
on
you.
All of our labels, this product is not recommended for human consumption.
Exactly.
Or no, not intended. Not intended for human consumption.
Very good.
Thank you.
Oh, I had one more story concerning chickens.
Oh, yeah.
This farmer in Ohio told me he raises a couple hundred chickens every summer. And he told me that normally they're fairly listless, especially in the summer heat. They like to stay close to their water and their food. And he said that the giving them sea crop in their water, that they would range as far as 300 feet away from their food. And he said that his feed bill went in half because they were out eating bugs and foraging and feeding themselves.
Oh.
Yeah, had a lot more energy than normal.
Now, a couple years ago, you did something that I objected to. You drowned some mice. But around that time, other people were reporting similar results, just consuming the Ormus, various Ormus products. So it might be instructive to tell people what happened when you did that.
Well, there is there are conventional methods or established methods for doing research with rodents.
Mm-hmm.
When you're trying to see what the effect of a substance is on a biological system that is somewhat similar to human beings. So I set up a fairly standard test. It's called forced swim testing, where you take the mice and you treat them however it is you're going to treat them for a certain period of time, and then you put them in a container where they have no choice except to swim, and you measure the length of time that it takes them before they reach terminal exhaustion and drown. So I did this, something I'll never do again because it was extremely unpleasant. But nonetheless, I did it because I wanted to find out what effect the... Now, this wasn't sea crop. This is my liquid chi product, which is a mixture of seawater precipitates and extract from volcanic materials. The results of this. Now, there's a couple of interesting things. The population that wasn't treated, the control, they really were kind of vicious, and the dominant male will go around and bite the testes off of the less dominant males and kill them. And we had quite a bit of mortality in the untreated group, 30% mortality in the untreated group just from viciousness. There was no mortality in the treated group, none.
They were less aggressive.
They were much less aggressive during the 30-day period, yeah. And generally in better health. They looked better. The test itself, the forced swim testing, the results are just almost
unbelievable. The average length that the untreated control were able to swim before terminal exhaustion was 257 minutes each. The treated population, the average length of time that they endured was 840 minutes. So just a tremendous difference there. Well, let's see, 3.27 times greater.
Well, one would expect similar results with athletic performance, then, wouldn't one?
Well, yes, you would. And by the way, I was giving a very large dose here. 40 times what would be the normal dose for human beings. Because, you know, 30 days in the lifetime of a mouse, they only live, you know, I forget what it is, a year and a half maximum, I think. 30 days in their lifetime is equivalent to years in the lifetime of the human being. And I wanted to see what a very large dose would do over that duration of time. So I gave them the equivalent of like 40 times what the normal human dose would be to see if they're...
Instead of the normal dose to be?
Well, for the liquid chi product that I make, I recommend a maximum of 1 tablespoon per day.
Okay, good. Now, there's one really fascinating thing that you talked about on our original conversation. And one thing, a word that you skipped over, was bioactivity. Would you explain what bioactivity is, and then we'll go on to the next part?
Well, you know, what is the effect on a biological system of a substance? Is the substance bioactive? Does it change the normal activity in that system? And this gets into the field of epigenetics, where you look for what factors express, other than DNA, the normal DNA sequence, what factors affect the way that the organism's genes express themselves.
Is this also the effectiveness in a biological system?
Well, yeah, that is the whole purpose of experiments, to determine the bioactivity of the substance is to see what effect it has on a biological system. Yeah.
One of the references you made to this bioactivity was an experiment that was done with a whole bunch of chickens.
Yeah, I gave the results on that a little bit ago.
Okay, so have you done any other experiments on animals or birds of any kind?
I have not myself, no. But we're trying to set up another large test on poultry in the United States, hopefully sometime later this year.
Now, one really fascinating thing that you also mentioned, but didn't go into much depth on, and that is that you used to go out in a boat. I think it might have been in the pre-call where you mentioned going out in the boat.
I did. I used to go 35 miles offshore and put a couple of hundred feet of hose over side to get through the Columbia plume. We live close to the mouth of the Columbia River, and the fresh water, being lighter than the salt water, will tend to persist and float on top of the seawater for a long period of time. That's referred to as the Columbia plume. So we'd put over enough hose, a couple of hundred feet, to get through that. At that time, I thought that the deeper water would have a better mineral content, And I went out to where the water coming up out of the Aleutian Trench striking the continental shelf came up this offshore feature called the Astoria Canyon. And in the phosphorus content, I could determine that the water on a whole was, even though I was only 200 feet from the surface, the water as a whole was from a depth of 500 feet. The Aleutian Trench itself is a couple thousand feet deeper than that. What I found out in time, years of testing and testing all up and down the West Coast and both sides of the Baja Peninsula and the Mexican mainland, is that mineral content in itself is not a predictor of bioactivity. I've had materials with considerably more mineral content that were not as bioactive as other sources that had less mineral content.
And you suspect that that's due to the ormus content?
Absolutely.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Which varies by a number of factors. Number one is the watershed involved. Are there precious metals in the watershed, contributing fresh waters? And I also believe that it involves biological content, which of course is in your nearshore waters due to phosphorus being brought up off the sea bottom, stimulating phytoplankton bloom, and then
mm-hmm.
with the phytoplankton you get everything else. You get the bacteria that graze on the phytoplankton. You get they're the bottom of the food chain. You get everything else that feeds all the way on up the food chain active in your coastal waters.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have the byproducts of all of that, which I believe that the ormus in seawater, at least in those areas, is in intimate contact with the biological matter.
So you made a major connection in your own research, Arthur, between how much life is in the water and the amount of precipitate that you would get out. Is that correct? And also the amount of bioactivity or usefulness in biological organisms when you applied your ormus to that. Am I correct with that?
Well, what I have found is that the biological content is more important than the mineral content.
So where did you find the places that had the highest biological content?
Well, up and down the coast. I haven't done comparisons on the East Coast. I have not dealt with waters in the Gulf of Mexico or the Atlantic, so I kind of hesitate to make broad statements. But in general, for the West Coast, the higher the precious metal content of the contributing watersheds, the more activity I see in the precipitous drive from the seawater to which they contribute.
Very good.
Well, that's pretty interesting. And so, given that you have a boat, I mean, where do you harvest your water from now, or do you get it like I do from the seashore?
Had a boat. Gotten rid of that. I found out I didn't need it. Out at the mouth of the bay here, just a few hundred yards inside the bar, I find that the water is 80% as good as it is 10 miles offshore, and I don't need a boat to get that. I have a intake pipe that runs 700 feet from my building, and I can just flip a switch now and bring the water in. I have to process 20% more, but that's no big deal when I can get it so easily.
It also means you can sell your product at a reasonable level.
Absolutely. Yeah, we started when we first went after the agricultural market, we were priced 40% higher than we currently are.
Uh-huh.
After the first year, I dropped prices 40%, and I would like to eventually drop them again. If we can achieve enough volume, then maybe we can look forward at dropping prices even more than where they are now.
What are your prices currently? I know that if you buy a quart or a gallon, that it's considerably more expensive than if you buy 5 gallons or 500 gallons or whatever.
Yeah, we've got the prices set to where we never undercut any of our dealers. Because, you know, the dealer has to be able to buy from us wholesale, transport it to wherever they are, containerize it, whatever size container they're going to put it in, and just sell it and make a profit. So we never compete with our dealers. So that's one reason our prices are where they are. On the smaller containers, we also include shipping up through the gallon size. So we've got that built in there.
I have a small garden. It's probably 100 square yards. How much of the seed crop would go on a garden about that size?
Well, we like to see about 4 gallons to an acre.
Uh-huh.
So you sound like you're well under a fourth of an acre. So I you know, 1 gallon seed crop would last you 1 or 2 years.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, how much is that gallon, Arthur?
In the States, $59. And that includes shipping. And we ship same price to Canada. Although we have a distributor in Canada now who's taking it across the border in larger quantities, and we're referring a lot of our Canadian business to him.
Now, one of the things that I completely forgot to ask you, and I'm kind of going to put you on the spot here because of necessity, usually we have our guests donate one or two of their products as a raffle prize. Are you okay with that?
Oh, sure. I'd donate a gallon to someone.
Right, because we usually have a raffle, and I completely forgot to ask you, and I'm sorry I have to do this kind of like twist your arm in public here, and I appreciate you coming to the party with that. Well, Barry will be able to run his random number generator and find out who won that prize any moment now.
I will do it as we continue here.
So some lucky person is going to get that gallon of sea crop, which we thank you for.
You're welcome.
And what's amazing is that consistently, I've seen some of the loveliest people win the Live Alchemy raffle prizes, and just a lovely bonus that people get from being able to contribute Barry's work, and they people who are subscribers, or effectively what we call benefactors, seem to always scoop the winnings, which is neat. Another thing that we talked about, and I'd love you to talk about, is the effectiveness in foods.
How do you find the nutritional value of the foods has jumped when people have used C crop on their different crops?
Well, the testing that's been done, shows that the food is more nutrient dense. In the case of cattle, they need to eat less of it, and with poultry as well, they need to eat less food in order to achieve the same result.
So when you say less, are we talking, in the magnitude of even 5% less or 10% less?
Or as much as 20 to 30%.
That's huge!
It's huge. Yes, it is.
I mean, that's a huge saving on food costs for a little bit of C crop.
Yeah. In poultry, it was, the results vary, but in caged poultry, average is 6 to 10%. Less food for the same amount of weight gain. Cattle, in the wintertime, hay-fed cattle, we've seen 20 to 30% less food consumption.
I've got a winner. The winner is Dr. Kate. I'll send you, Dennis, contact information as well as Arthur.
Okay, Kate.
Just let me know where to send it.
Kate is on the East Coast, I believe.
Okay. Well, Dr. Jen is going to be annoyed it wasn't her.
Oh, yeah.
But then she doesn't have a garden, as you know.
There you go.
What's really interesting, Arthur, is I've noticed that with a number of my friends is they have put hummus that we make on their bushes in their garden, like just in the bushes in their front garden and so on, and the new growth is double to triple the size of the old growth leaves.
Yeah, and you'll get twice the blooms, and the blooms will stay on longer. You'll get, if it bears fruit, you'll get a better fruit set. Fruit will be larger. It'll taste better. It just, the results are, what it appears to do is allow plants to express their full genetic potential.
So we can pretty much assume, therefore, if that's so for plants and animals, it's also so for humans, like you and me.
Well, one would hope so. I sure wish I'd have started when I was a teenager instead of later in life.
Let me ask you this. This is kind of like a bit of a personal question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. What difference have you noticed in your own personal happiness and fulfillment since you started having hummus in your life?
Tremendous difference.
How
would you characterize that? In what way would you give us an example of tremendousness?
Well, many of the spiritual qualities of Ormus are ineffable. It's simply not possible to express them.
That's right. And yet, we do love to express, or even to attempt to express, that satisfaction. And, I was at a party last night and someone was asking me about that very same subject. And like you're saying, it's impossible to describe, but we can't help trying. it's a good, fun thing to try.
It's an excellent tool. It's not an enlightenment pill by any means, but it's certainly an excellent tool.
You know, one of the first things that you said in the it might have even been in the pre-talk, but But one of the things you said was when you first made some ocean precipitate, you got a big high. And what was interesting last night at that party,
That's not what I said. I did not say I had a big high. I said I had an ecstatic experience.
You felt
well, there is.
If I wanted a big high, I'd take something to give me a big high.
I would consider an ecstatic experience to be a big high. I don't, how much higher do you go than ecstatic experience?
Well, this is true.
Yeah.
But that's not the connotation that I normally associate with high.
Yeah. I do apologize. It's definitely associations that I get with high as I understand it, which is just elated, which is totally, totally experiencing fulfillment and enjoyment. And it's interesting because it reminded me when I heard you say it, of the ecstatic experience, of this woman last night at a party that I went to. She owns a health food shop in a town close to here, and she came to learn the wet method with me one time about a year ago, and I dropped in to see her, and she scrounged a bit of my latest ormus, which was particularly yummy, and she gave some to her daughter, who's also working at the health food shop, who's, you know, about 20, 25, and her daughter had a taste of this and said, this is, I presume that she had some experience, she said, this is a bit like having LSD. Now, maybe she was being exaggerating somewhat, but it was certainly gave me a certain level of satisfaction, a simple, humble, wet method almost, and have that kind of level of elation and perceptual change.
Well, I've had them both, and I really don't find a much of a comparison between the two.
Yeah, well, same. But the thing is, what I'm noticing is that some people just get elated significantly, and Richard Idians, who you were talking to before the main call started, we did a conference call specifically on the subject of as Richard called it, following his elation. Richard, you still there, buddy?
You betcha. Can you hear me?
Why don't you speak for a couple of minutes on that, and then we're going to have to wind the call up, because I just realized we're pretty much out of time, but I just wanted to touch on the one subject, which is just the sweetness and lightness and joy that can consistently and frequently is associated with the taking of ormus.
Maybe I'll throw that in with another point that I wanted to, I think I would be remiss in not mentioning it. The first time I experienced this elation was at my grandparents' place in Gowan Harbor, and he had a big garden, and he was an organic farmer, and one of my chores in the summertime was to go out and gather this green seaweed lettuce that accumulated on the beach in front of his house, and wheelbarrow it up to a compost heap on which he'd heap, always throw in a little wood ash and stuff like that, let it sit over the winter, and then he'd dig it into the garden. That garden, just standing in the middle of that garden, would give anybody an intense, ecstatic rush. It was just a fantastic garden. Also, his vegetables were huge, and they were, to my way of thinking, they were the epitome of ormus vegetables. He actually got featured in local newspaper articles for growing outsized vegetables and really delicious foods. It was absolutely, I haven't experienced better before or since. It was just amazing. This is when I was maybe 7 or 8 years old, and I always wondered what his secret was. And I was part of it. I was picking this stuff up. And he was basically doing the wet method process in the compost heap. I know that now. He's no longer with us, but he basically had the system down to a science. And having eaten from that garden for many years, actually, he grew enough vegetables in his garden to keep him and his whole family supplied with really superior produce just about year-round. And he also grew things that were really designed for this climate, like cantaloupes. And keep in mind, this is in, very, very near to where I live in Campbell River. He lived on Quadra Island. He was growing tropical things in a temperate climate with alarming success. He grew the darndest cantaloupes you ever had in your life. They were great, big, juicy, sweet, and they'd ripen, you know. Other people tried it, and some of them actually managed to get them to grow using hot frames and different hothouse techniques, but they never got them to ripen. His were beautiful. They were just fantastic. And he would grow beefsteak tomatoes that were larger than cantaloupes regularly. And he had giant walnuts, too. He had a walnut tree. And he'd grow all kinds of different things that nobody else seemed to have any success with. My grandmother was producing, she had figs that were just absolutely delicious. I remember sitting under that fig tree and just eating figs until I was paralyzed. They were so good. And yet, my mom tried to grow it, and she didn't have the same method, and it had a few little tiny wizened up fruits on it, and they were never really edible. They were just, you know, the soil just didn't have it there. So everything that Arthur says, I can absolutely vouch for, and I know that the source, or the sea, is definitely the source for many of the trace minerals that make up the necessary nutrients for anything growing, including people. And I learned early on, and partly because of this experience, that wherever I could tune into that feeling, it was a good place to be. And it started turning up things like mushrooms and different things I'd find in the forest. And whenever I got that feeling, I'd start looking around a little bit. And I'd always find... So, anyhow, that's my little short blurb. And maybe if Arthur has any comments on that.
Didn't you mention something about you thought native peoples knew about this stuff?
I'm sure that's where my grandfather got the information. And I've talked to some elders that about things. This is before I was into Ormus, but for one thing, a lot of people thought that war paint would supposedly make them look scary. It wasn't that at all. It makes ashes and seawater and smeared all over their bodies so that if they got wounded, it would heal right away.
Oh. Well,
and the wood ash that they used was always from certain trees. And I've got a friend in up north who's, I'll have to check back with him on that because he knows quite a lot about this stuff. He's,
our next guest toward the end of this month is a guy named Dorian Today. And Dorian has been going, examining ancient petroglyphs throughout American Southwest. In fact, he's got people doing it around the world now that seem to be evidence that ancient people were using these materials, getting them from rocks and so on, and using them for health benefits and that sort of thing. It's going to be a very interesting call. Be sure to tell people about it because this is going to be really great. And I think a lot of his observations support some of
Arthur's observation that wherever there's precious metal sources upstream, those seem to be good good sources for the ormus in seawater.
Yeah, I would certainly agree with that. And I think our seawater might have a little bit more platinum than, which is very, very hard to separate, of course. But and the reason for that is the granitic basalts that we have around here seem to be loaded with it. All M-state, of course, and not mineable.
Right.
But the rocks and the springs around here really, especially around that granite, like Quadra Island is basically made up of that, granitic and limestone. And the springs, that especially the one on my grandfather's property, that he had a spring that was reputed to be the natives thought it was the Fountain of Youth. And the water over there is just absolutely delicious. That was another thing about that place. You could just drink that water, and it would quench your thirst right away. But you couldn't seem to get enough of it. You know, to sit down and drink 2 or 3 quarts of it, just because it was so good.
Yeah.
And that that comes, I think, from the filtering it through the granitics and the rocks and the. On Quadra Island, which are all that same kind. It's the same most of southwestern BC.
Thomas, are you still on the phone, on the call, Thomas? You may have to unmute to answer. Thomas in Georgia gets his water from a spring that was associated with eternal youth, so to speak. And he runs a magnetic trap on it. Thomas has set up a basically a Ormus conference in Georgia for, I believe it's the last weekend of the summer. Are you there, Thomas?
What part of September is that?
Oh, I've forgotten the exact date. It's Labor Day. Is it Labor Day or? I'm not sure.
When is Labor Day?
Last weekend of the summer. And I think first weekend in September.
John, are we done?
Well, Thomas wanted me to ask you, Arthur, if you might be interested in coming and giving a presentation there. One very interesting thing is Thomas is right in the midst of the chicken raising capital of America. So it may be something of value to talk to some of the chicken farmers around there.
Could very well.
Would I give a cluck?
Yeah.
Right.
I bet they would when they look at the bottom line.
Oh,
yeah.
That one I'll have
especially
to.
Especially how much money they'll save on food.
Right. That one I'll have to remember.
Good.
It's September 5th, 6th, and 7th. Sorry, I got muted.
I'm sorry. Okay, you had to get off and then get back on, eh?
Yep.
Sorry about that.
No problem.
So why don't you give that a bit of consideration, Arthur? Whether you like to be a guest over that conference?
I certainly will.
I finally decided I'm going to come to that conference, Thomas.
Okay.
Oh, hooray. Well, glad to hear that.
When is that going to be?
Labor Day weekend, 5th, 6th, and 7th of September at Enota. That's E-N-O-T-A. They have details about it at enota.com. They have a website.
E-N-O-T-A
.com?
And I imagine you have details on your site, which is CherokeeGold.net, don't you, Thomas?
Well, I'll have details up within a few days. I'll also make some postings as well. There are accommodations from campsites up to cabins, private cabins, and everything in between. There are regional motels as well, and there will be food available. David Wolf will be speaking, who's a raw foodist, so there'll be raw food, and that is harvest time at the organic farm, so which is
Ormusized. They've been using Ormus on their farm, yeah.
For 2 years.
Yeah. Excellent.
Well, listen, on that high note, I'm going to have to scramble because the organic markets are closing any moment now, and I want to get there and get my victuals.
Oh, yes.
Well,
well
thanks
for
hosting us and thanks for speaking, Arthur.
So thank you for being our guest, Arthur. We've had a great time.
Yeah, well, thank you all for listening.
I was glad I got to listen to the last part of the call. It's Arlene, so thank you.
You're in turn.
I totally enjoyed the call as well. Can you hear me?
I can.
Yeah.
This is Charles Drigo. I have one more question, and maybe I can email Arthur on this. You'd mentioned earlier in the call that you would outline a precipitation method, but I don't think we got to that.
Okay. This was for reducing gold out of seawater precipitates.
That's correct.
Okay. What I did, first of all, was chlorination under electrolysis with carbon electrodes,
mm-hmm.
Mixture of hydrochloric, sulfuric, and sodium chloride. 30 volts DC at 1.5 amps, and did that for about 8 hours.
Mm-hmm.
Then in a distillation rig, that material was, filtered off the solids at that point, and then the filtrate in a distillation rig was evaporated to dryness and brought to red heat. And I've got to tell you that frequently I lost everything at this point.
My goodness.
Well, you want the best glassware you can get, and be aware that you may lose your flask.
Mm-hmm.
The idea is that, this is going to be, to an extent, reducing atmosphere because oxygen is excluded and you do have scrapings from your electrodes and a certain amount of organic carbon that was initially in solution.
Sure.
Okay, after you reach this point, then you're going to have a bunch of black solid material there, which you're going to want to take up in, depending on your method of parting, I assume that, you have some source of instruction on how to part precious metals. You go into whatever parting method you're going to get at that point and or not. You can proceed and go further with what I did from that point. Then was go into a thiourea elite solution, 1% hydrochloric, 5% thiourea, 1% hydrogen peroxide, and went into pressure oxidation with an internozone atmosphere at 9 pounds of pressure, and with an earth ground to the solution. And then did a sodium hydroxide precipitation and a fire assay on the precipitates.
And it's not necessarily a profitable way to do it.
Pardon?
and it isn't necessarily a profitable way to do it. It costs
more. Considering that, by conventional extraction methods, it takes about 100 million tons of seawater to give a gram of gold.
Mm-hmm.
Even at 500 times that, even at 500 grams, it means you've got to process, 100 million tons of seawater to get 500 grams. No, not profitable.
Maybe useful for assay.
Pardon?
But maybe useful for assay.
I did it to establish and prove for my own purposes that precious metals were involved in the bioactivity that I was seeing.
Very good.
That's wonderful. Thank you very much.
Thank you for that. And on that subject, thanks for being our guest, buddy. And we're going to call it.
Okay.
It's over and out. And what I'd like you to do is just say your name and say goodbye before you leave.
Arthur Ziegler. Goodbye.
Barry.
Yes. Dylan.
How you doing?
Doing good.
Good. You got your garden in?
I do. I've already got lettuce as much as 2 inches high. It snowed yesterday.
I'm sorry, what?
It snowed yesterday, but I've already got lettuce. It's about 2 inches high.
It snowed?
It snowed.
Well, we didn't get any snow, but our lettuce is about an inch and a half, maybe. Just
yeah.
Get going. Hasn't grabbed on yet.
This is all volunteer from last year.
Most of ours is, too.
Yeah.
I have some that have, been rollovers for about 6 years now, and others that I got new seed and planted in. There were a few volunteers from them.
Oh, yeah. Well, these are the volunteers from the 4.5-foot tall lettuce last year. So I think we may have to have a trellis this year.
What do you mean? You mean 4.5 feet after they grew their stem when it was over?
That's where the seed pods were 4.5 feet up.
Right. All right. Well, carry on. I'll let you go.
Okay.
Take care.
Bye now.